Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Paul Wagner here, host of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place. If you like what you hear, we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. Now, to this week's episode. Previously on WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place.
Had someone get into a hospital and get into an area that's, you know, semi-controlled, semi-secure, that has on-site security, and, you know, murder somebody and then just vanish.
You could walk around that hospital freely. There were no check-in points. You have to give a badge. You have to give your ID.
Based on how security is in hospitals today, I would say yes, it was very inadequate. From what I understand, they only had one security officer who was patrolling the floors. So it was woefully inadequate at the time.
The murder of Sherry Crandall has gone unsolved for 23 years. The DNA and fingerprints, which in any investigation would be a huge benefit, have never been linked to anyone. That description of the killer, hospital housekeeper Edna Brown, gave police, it's been no help. The $26,000 reward for information has gone untouched. To call it a difficult and frustrating case to solve would just be a vast understatement. Prince George's County Police Detective Bernie Nelson, who was the lead detective at the hospital the night Sherry was murdered, and is still the lead investigator today, says the murder haunts him. It's personal now. At the end of episode 4, we told you that Detective Nelson went back to the FBI in the spring of 2020 to see if they could help one more time try and solve Sherry's murder. In recent years, Bernie had watched with interest as other law enforcement agencies used genealogy to help solve very difficult cold cases. Two companies in Virginia, Paramon Nanolabs and Bode Technology Group, had both begun forensic genealogy units, and they were using ancestry databases. You might not know this, but people upload their DNA into these types of websites in an effort to trace their heritage. When police tap into the databases, the hope is that they will find a genetic lead to the criminal they're looking for. Maybe a sister or an uncle that would have similar DNA. Detective Nelson has seen genealogy solve other high-profile murder cases, like the Golden State Killer in California and the Potomac River Rapist in Washington, D.C., a man police say raped as many as 9 women before killing a scientist, and now he was hoping it could finally, once and for all, be the key to solving Sherry's murder, too. So he asked the FBI to take the DNA of Sherry's killer, which, as a reminder, was found in a rape kit, to the Bode Technology Group. He wanted them to compare it to the hundreds of thousands of DNA records they had access to through GEDmatch and Family Tree USA. After all, what did he have to lose? The FBI agreed, and Bernie began to wait. One of the most recent cases Detective Nelson had seen solved by genealogy was in his home state of Maryland. The man's name was James Essel, found murdered inside his convenience store back in 1992. At the end of episode 4, I shared part of my interview with a woman named Perpetua Edwards. She's the daughter of James Essel. In 2020, Pep, as she's called by her friends, got the call she had been waiting to receive for 28 years.
He just told me that I'm sorry that I have to tell you like this, but we did locate the man who we believe murdered your father, and he was shot and killed this morning, and it's going to be on the news, And so we wanted to notify the family.
What did you think at that point?
I thought I was going to pass out.
I want to tell you more about the murder of James Essel because I think it will help you understand how genealogy has become such an important part of crime solving and why Detective Nelson is hopeful it can help in Sherry's case as well. Mr. Essel was a shopkeeper and a father. He immigrated to the U.S. from Ghana around 1959. After settling in the D.C. area, he worked as a banker and opened the Warababa restaurant on Kennedy Street in the northwest section of Washington, D.C. He purchased his convenience store in Comus, Maryland after retiring. Comus is a small, rural community of farms and single-family homes located at the northern tip of Montgomery County, Maryland, about 40 miles north of Washington, D.C. Montgomery County is the state's most populous county with more than 1 million residents, but stepping into Comus, you couldn't be farther from the hustle and bustle of the city if you tried. It's a different world. Essel's Market sat near Sugarloaf Mountain on a winding country road about 3 miles off of the closest interstate. The small, white building with a white tin roof had a welcoming front porch with benches for customers to relax on after buying a snack or a drink. There were 2 gas pumps out front and a sign inside the store's large picture window offering live bait for sale. Next to the market was a large single-family home, and just down the road, a few hundred yards, was the popular Comus Inn. According to Montgomery County Police, 57-year-old James Essel was working alone inside the market on Sunday evening, March 22, 1992, when a man walked in and purchased a bottle of cheap wine. The last sale on the register indicated it was 5:39 p.m. Investigators believe the man who made that purchase then decided to rob the store, and it quickly turned violent. Essel was stabbed more than 20 times with what police believe was a knife and pieces of the wine bottle the killer had just purchased. Essel's body was found by a customer who came into the store at around 6 p.m. When police arrived, they found money missing from the cash register. Evidence shows the shopkeeper fought back and the attacker was cut, possibly on the hand, leaving blood in the cash register, the floor of the shop, and near the door as he escaped. Shards of the wine bottle were found all over the floor, but no knife was recovered at the scene. That's where the case pretty much falls off a cliff. The killer slipped off into the night, leaving police the trail of blood and little more, just like the person who killed Sherry Crandall. Pep, one of James Essel's 7 children, remembers getting the news while out of town.
My brother had called me. The police had called my younger brother, Mike, because he worked in the store with him. So that was the number that the family number that they had with them having the same last name. And I remember when Mike had called me, I couldn't believe it because I, at the time, I'm a systems engineer and I was working out of town and I was packing to go back to Chicago for my job. And he called, it was like 10 o'clock at night. And I was actually in shock. I couldn't believe it. I was hysterical to the point where my family told me that he wasn't dead because I wouldn't calm down. They said that they took him to the hospital, not knowing that they knew he was dead, but they were trying to get me to calm down. It was just, it was very, very, very tough for me.
You were tight with your dad.
Yes. It was just, you know, shocking. Nothing like that has ever happened to anyone that I know, thank God. And, you know, for him to be such a kind-hearted, you know, he would extend credit to everyone in the store. And if you didn't have enough money and, you know, he'll just let you go and say, pay me when you can. So it was just hard to believe.
There were no witnesses, no surveillance cameras, and no cell phones to track back in 1992. All they had was that DNA pulled from the killer's blood. For detectives, it was an incredibly valuable piece of evidence, but only if you could find a match. Despite the best efforts of the Montgomery County Police, the investigation went nowhere. The case went cold, and for years the detectives had very little to work with. The DNA profile sat in CODIS, the National DNA Database, but there were no hits. Nothing. Terribly frustrating for the Essel family and for the police. It was as if they were chasing someone's shadow.
I felt like I had an empty hole in my heart, and not knowing what would fill that gap. You know, you just feel incomplete, if that makes any sense.
Pep said with no matches on the DNA left at the scene, the Essel family was left to wait and wonder if they would ever see justice for their dad. 10 years went by, and then another 10. And then, in 2016, 24 years after their father was murdered, Perpetua Edwards gets a call from Montgomery County Police Detective Mark Janney.
He told me that they're going to reopen my dad's case, and I was kind of shocked that they were doing that. I thought it was incredible. And I remember him coming to my home for an interview, and I remember asking him why this case, you know, after all of this time. And he told me that he was looking through a lot of old cases, and my dad's case really spoke to him. And since, you know, they had a strong DNA sample, he wanted to go ahead and initiate the Parabon process, which is the DNA match.
In Ancestry databases.
Yes.
So he told you that in 2016 that they were going to go that way.
Yes.
And what was your thinking at that point? Because that was not a process that was well known in the public at that point.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, I felt very honored and blessed, first of all, that they chose my dad's case. But in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, good luck with that. I really didn't expect anything to come of it. I mean, it had been so many, you know, decades, and now all of a sudden bringing it back up, and I hadn't heard anything about Parabon and that process. Even though he explained it to me, I was like, oh, that's like a needle in a haystack.
What Detective Janney found so promising was a new process developed by Parabon Nanolabs of Reston, Virginia, a process that would take the killer's DNA and turn it into a composite, an image of what the man may look like. But the scientists also said they could give investigators more information about the killer than police ever had before. And they delivered.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
In June of 2017, Montgomery County Police held a news conference in which that composite sketch was released, and additional information about the suspect in the Essel case was revealed. The voices you'll hear next are Detective Janney, followed by Dr. Ellen Graytak of Parabon Nanolabs, speaking at that press conference.
As you can see, they were able to analyze the DNA we had in the case and come up with a composite of the subject. We also had them do a age-enhanced composite of 25 years later because we don't know the age of the suspect at the time of the murder.
The technology that was used to develop this composite is called DNA phenotyping. So traditional DNA forensics matches DNA found at a crime scene to a suspect who's already been identified or to a database. But when you don't have any hits, the DNA currently can't tell you anything else about that person. What we do is we analyze the DNA and pick out the pieces of it that actually determine what someone looks like. So instead of treating DNA like a fingerprint, we treat it like a blueprint of that person. So what we have is basically a large database, thousands and thousands of subjects of volunteers who have given us their DNA and also information about their appearance. So what we've been able to do from that is find what are the pieces of DNA that associate with particular traits. What is in common between people with blue eyes that's different from people with brown eyes? And so on for other facial features, skin color, hair color, ancestry. And from all of that, we can build this composite. That composite is basically a description of that person based on the information in the DNA. We think of it like a genetic witness. It's not going to be the driver's license photograph of that person because there's a lot of information about appearance that's not written in the DNA. So you notice that the original composite is at a standard age of 25 and a standard body weight. Age and body weight are not written in the DNA. They're part of the environment. And so all we can do is produce that composite at that age and then do an age progression. We have a certified forensic artist on staff who can progress that composite to produce an older image. But again, there's a lot of information that's not written in the DNA, such as weight, tattoos, hairstyle, things like that. So the goal of this is really to help investigators figure out who they should and especially should not be looking at. There are a vast majority of people who do not match this composite, which we hope will help them figure out who it could have been.
The composite they drew for the Essel case showed what appeared to be a light-skinned black male whose ancestry may have been from Central or South America. Now, it's important to understand what happens from here. At this point, the job of the lab is done. They've created a sketch, and they've identified possible relatives of the killer. Names of those potential relatives are then turned back over to detectives, who are then responsible for probing the family trees they now have in their possession and connecting the dots if there are any. While the sketch created by Parabon didn't lead detectives anywhere in the Essel case, the ancestral connections they found did.
My name is Donna Fenton, and I am a senior assistant state's attorney with the Montgomery County State's Attorney's Office.
Donna Fenton first learned of the Essel murder in late 2019 or early 2020 after the Montgomery County Police Department had reopened the case. As they got closer to identifying a suspect, Fenton was assigned the case for prosecution.
How this was first used was adoptees looking to find extended family. I don't believe that when this was created, it was intended to be used in any law enforcement sense.
But they've been remarkably successful in tracking down very difficult cases to solve.
Very successful.
And that's what's exciting about it.
Very exciting as a prosecutor.
Can imagine. It's exciting for a reporter like me who follows these cases.
It was a little daunting thinking that I was going to be the first in Montgomery County to try to admit this evidence in front of a judge or a jury, but the evidence was very, very strong. And as soon as we got that final hit, I believed we had enough, obviously, for a arrest warrant, but I also believed that we had enough to indict Mr. Hewitt's on murder charges and be successful beyond a reasonable doubt in front of a jury.
The Mr. Hewitts Donna Fenton is referring to is Hans Alejandro Hewitts, a 51-year-old auto mechanic living in Virginia Beach, Virginia at the time. Police closed in on him in February of 2020 after an exhaustive search through census, death, and other records, a search that began after police got a match on at least one family tree from an ancestry database. By working backwards, Montgomery County Police Officer Steve Smugareski was able to use genealogy to trace a family tree, first to Hans Hewitt's brother Henry, according to a court affidavit filed in the case, before confirming the man they were actually after was Hans. Officer Steve Smugareski's expertise is not in genealogy. Smugs, as he's called on the force, is just one of those guys who has a knack for locating people through documents and records. He's the type of guy who can go down the rabbit hole, follow the clues, and actually connect the dots. He says he volunteered for a special assignment in the cold case division after his fellow officers challenged him to find the relatives of Officer Joseph Case, a Montgomery County police officer killed in the line of duty all the way back in 1928. Officials on the force wanted to honor Case at a memorial service, but had lost touch with Case's family. That's when they turned to Smuggs.
They gave me a file folder which had an obituary from the time from 1928. It had one census record, and it had a marriage certificate. And so I started to do some research, and I found a few things here and there. And I found out he had no children, so I couldn't trace forward, you know, from his family. And then, so then I traced back, and I hit a little stumble, you know, because I couldn't find many records with about his mother, but I was able to find her siblings. So I was able to go back and to her parents, and then trace the siblings down to actually find relatives living in the area who we invited to the service, and they come every year since.
The successful search, mostly done in his own time, took Smuggs about a year to complete, but it got him thinking. Maybe his knack for finding people would work well in the county's cold case division, so that's when he decided to volunteer. I was eager to meet Officer Smugareski after learning he played a key role in tracking down Hans Hewitz, as well as suspects in other cases that had gone unsolved for years. We talked on the phone a few times before getting together in the fall of 2020 at a park in Kensington, Maryland. Like many of the interviews I've conducted for this podcast, the coronavirus was a major concern, and so we sat outside more than 6 feet apart. Officer Smugareski's a big guy with an easygoing manner. He has sandy brown hair and the build of a man who could play tackle or tight end for a football team. Smuggs was not permitted to speak specifically about the Hewitz case, for reasons you will understand later in this episode. So instead, to get a feel for how he does his work, I asked him about another case he helped solve before the Hewitz case, a serial rapist who was preying on elderly women in and around Germantown, Maryland, a community about a 30-minute drive and 22 miles outside Washington, D.C. Something interesting to note about this case: while Smuggs had accepted the position in the cold case division, he hadn't officially started yet. He was still working as a bike cop, but his new bosses asked him to take a look at new information they had just received from Parabon Nanolabs.
So I sat down on a Friday night after I got done with my shift, and I just started playing around with a couple genealogy sites, and I started making a few connections here and there, family-wise, working up from our shared person. And by midnight on Saturday, I had hit on, because a lot of everybody was coming back to Frederick and West Virginia and such, in different areas, and nobody really to Montgomery County. And then by midnight on Saturday, I hit a line that came back to Montgomery County.
So you, by Saturday night, you get a line on a family from Montgomery County, is that right?
Yes.
And tell me about that. What happened next?
Well, I was going to call my buddy in cold case at midnight, and I was like, nah, he's probably asleep.
Because you're excited at this point.
I'm excited at this point. I'm like, I think I got something, but, you know, I don't know. I haven't been doing this all that long. And so I called him the next morning on Sunday, and you know, I told him what I found. And at this point, I didn't isolate on a single person yet. And we start playing around with a few things over the phone. And he said, how does this person fit? And I was like, let me check. And I went back to the obituary that I found. And I found his name. And I said, well, let me do a little more research. And I found another obituary to tie this person definitely to the tree. And then I went to a chart that shows you the level of where our suspect shared, the level of DNA that shared with our suspect.
The person Officer Smogorecki mentioned fit perfectly into the suspect's description based on the DNA connections in the family tree, but more work needed to be done before detectives were convinced the puzzle pieces fit.
Ultimately, they got a search warrant for his DNA based on their investigation.
And when the lab compared the suspect's DNA with the rapist's DNA, it was a moment, Officer Smogorecki told me, that left him stunned and incredibly proud. What did you think at that point?
I was totally blown away. I had thought, really, you know, this is really crazy. You know, it was funny because the year prior, I went to a cold case conference training, and I sat there and I was like, oh, it'd be pretty awesome to be able to help solve a case like this someday in my career. And a year later, I'm right there in the mix.
So when they told you that they had a DNA match, can you take me back to that moment?
It was kind of crazy. I was actually not working, and I was cleaning the bathrooms in my house. And I heard my cell phone or my text ring go off, and you know, and I knew that, you know, they were going to do the sample that day. And so I went down and I looked at my text, and it said hit. And you know, I don't know, it was just a flood of emotions. You know, it was crazy.
That's right. Officer Smogorecki, who had not even technically begun his temporary assignment with the Cold Case Division, had just helped solve a case that had baffled investigators for more than a decade. Marion Michael Alexander, a father of four, pleaded guilty in February of 2019 and is now serving life in prison. Turning back to the Essel case now, I told you Officer Smogorecki was not allowed to discuss it specifically, so instead, I asked Prosecutor Donna Fenton to tell me everything she knew about how the killer was identified.
We had had several meetings where I was brought up to speed about the investigation and that they were getting closer, and when I had probably the most informative meeting with the police department was when we were awaiting the results of Henry's voluntarily given DNA sample. That, I believe, was done either at our lab or at a different lab down in Virginia, Bode Technologies, which the Montgomery County Police contract work out to quite frequently. But then it comes back to our lab, and our lab director made the confirmation of the familial link.
Was there a thought at that point that Henry Uitz may have been the suspect? Or you didn't know until you got the DNA?
I don't believe we knew until we got the DNA, because, again, how phenotyping works is really working through public databases. And this detective that I had mentioned with the police department takes those publicly available databases and starts cross-referencing the samples, and then starts really a public record information gathering through social media and land records and birth records, and finding various individuals that might be associated with individuals who have voluntarily consented to have their DNA uploaded to these databases with these publicly held companies.
Would it have been normal protocol for you to go out with the detectives when they spoke with Mr. Uitz, Henry Uitz?
No, No. That would not have been within our protocol.
And you did not do that?
No, I did not do that. Nor did I, when they went to speak with Hans Hewitz, I was not going to travel down to Virginia Beach with them, but we were in hourly contact while they were there.
Then you zero in on Hans.
Correct.
How long before detectives went down to speak with Hans, how much time went by between the DNA testing of Henry to when you approached Hans?
They were moving fairly quickly. I think once we had an address for him and the police were able to find a place of employment, and they were able to coordinate with Virginia Beach, because we traveled down there with numerous homicide detectives and officers with our repeat offender unit, who are responsible for taking fugitives into custody and serving a warrant such as this. So I believe we had 8 to 15 officers down in Virginia Beach when we wanted to interview Hans. Everything needed to be in place. What we had to do was we needed to obtain a Virginia search warrant for the DNA. We had probable cause to obtain a search warrant, we believed, based on all of the information that we had from Parabon and from Henry Hewitz. We had probable cause at that point, and that warrant was approved. Once that warrant was approved, we know that we needed to serve that warrant, and we believed we would have one opportunity to speak with Hans Hewitz. At that point in time, detectives approached him very early in the morning at his place of employment. They spoke with him. No admissions were made, but at that point in time, the search warrant was presented to him, and he had to provide a DNA sample at that point in time. He returned to work, and detectives kept him under surveillance through the entirety of that day. Meanwhile, the sample was driven from Virginia Beach up here to Rockville. The DNA was tested, and a match was confirmed to the material from the scene of the murder of Mr. Essel. At that point in time, we had probable cause to obtain an arrest warrant to arrest Mr. Hewitz. By the time all of that was done, it was very late in the evening that same day. The warrant was entered into the system, and the officers elected, for their safety and a lot of unknowns that were happening in terms of individuals in Mr. Hewitz's home, his wife having been a former law enforcement officer, retired, but we believed there could be weapons inside the home. It was down a long driveway. The officers are very experienced in apprehending suspects. They did not feel it was safe for them to make entry to the home, elected to wait outside the home until the next morning when he did leave the home. He was leaving his residence. We don't know where he was going. And when the officers attempted to stop him, immediately after he left his driveway, he immediately produced two guns.
Two guns?
Two.
And I've seen this video that was shot by a neighbor. It looks like the standoff lasted a few minutes.
I think it was almost seven.
7 minutes?
Yes. Yeah.
No, yes, you do. You have kids. Don't do this. Police, drop the gun, man. Don't do it.
He's got kids.
We got to.
No.
Gun down, talk to
I think he's got kids. And they're telling him not to do it for the kids' sake. Oh, he's got multiple guns.
Don't do this! Don't do it! Drop the gun! Drop the gun!
Oh, were you aware of what was going on at that point?
I had spoken to the detective earlier that morning. She was waiting for him to be taken into custody. She, Detective Leggett, and she was down in Virginia Beach and was waiting for the warrant to be served. She said they were going to stop him as soon as he left the house. And then 10 minutes later, she called me and said he had pulled guns on the officer, and I hate this term, but the suicide by cop. I don't know what the legal term would be. I believe he was killed by police officers when he refused to put down the two weapons that were eventually found with him in the car.
Donna Fenton says during the standoff, Hans Uetz got on the phone and called his wife. She declined to say what the two may have said to each other, but Pep Edwards says detectives told her they could overhear the conversation.
He had the windows up, but he was on the phone with his wife. His wife was in a few cars behind him. They wouldn't let her onto the street, and the police was with her. The phone was on speaker. All I do know is he did tell his wife that when he was very young, he did something very bad, and he was very sorry for it.
In the summer of 2020, about 6 months after Hans Uetz's death in Virginia Beach, I reached out to his widow, a retired D.C. police officer, to see if she would talk to me for this podcast, but she declined. Pep Edwards says soon thereafter, the Montgomery County Police reached out to offer a briefing to the family on how they had solved the case with genealogy.
I had no idea that the police department and the detectives go into such depth when they're researching a case. And I mean, it was like, okay, so when we went in for the briefing, I didn't know what to expect. I had never been in something like this. And I know my memory can kind of go all over the place. So I said, let me write up a list of questions so that I won't forget to ask anything. And so I had probably about 40 questions on my list. Meeting Detective Leggett and hearing her walk through the entire story was so thorough. And her attention to detail was on point. I mean, she answered so many of my questions openly and honestly that it left me with very few questions at the end to ask.
Edwards says she and her family were so appreciative of the work done on their father's case. She wrote a letter to Marcus Jones, the chief of police, in which she starts out with praise for all of the detectives who worked on her dad's case, including Officer Steve Smug Smugareski. I asked her to read that portion of her letter for me.
Wow. What he did to solve my dad's case was mind-blowing. His explanation of how he got from point A to Z was mesmerizing. I really feel that he should teach a class on how this DNA research works. So fascinating. Smug's attachment, care, and concern for my dad's case was very touching. With this being his fourth case closed in the past 1.5 years, we all said and agreed that he should head up the SMUG, meaning Senseless Murders Uncovered Group, division for the Montgomery County Police Department, and Rachel should be his first recruit after she graduates. My family is truly appreciative for his knowledge and for applying it to my dad's case. I chose this day, March 13, 2020, to write this thank you letter because this day we would have celebrated my dad's 85th birthday. This vital closure that your team has given me makes me finally able to say, happy birthday, Dad. You can now, after 28 years, finally rest in peace. Our sincerest thanks to your wonderfully talented staff. On behalf of the Essel family, may God continue to bless you all so that you can continue to protect and bless us citizens. With thanks, appreciation, and gratitude, Mrs. Perpetua Essel Edwards.
I told you earlier I would explain why Officer Smugareski was not allowed to discuss the Hewitts case with me. It turns out the officers who opened fire on Hewitts that February morning were part of Montgomery County's Repeat Offender Unit and were in Virginia Beach supporting county detectives there as deputized U.S. Marshals. You'll remember, Officer Smugareski works for the Montgomery County Police. At the time of my interview, the prosecutor in Virginia Beach was still investigating the officer's role in the shooting. However, in early November of 2020, the Commonwealth's attorney in Virginia Beach ruled the officer's actions were justified. In a report, the prosecutor's office said Hewitts confessed to officers after they stopped him outside his house that morning, telling them, "I killed somebody, and I'm going to do 30 years. The report also says in the phone call to his wife, Hewitts told her he had killed a man when he was drunk, that he could not go to prison, and there was only one way out. The report also revealed Hans Hewitts had two guns in the car with him, and they were both loaded and ready to fire. What's extraordinary about this case is the fact police could find no criminal records for Hans Hewitts. It's as if he killed James Essel, according to police, and then with tremendous remorse said nothing about it to anyone and decided to live the rest of his life on the right side of the law. Investigators have been unable to link Hewitts to any other crimes. Could that also be the case with the person who killed Sherry Crandall? Someone capable of a vicious rape and murder who also feels remorse and commits no further crimes? Detective Nelson might soon get his answer. Remember that Ancestry database DNA search that Bodie Technology Group was conducting for the Prince George's County Police and the Sherry Crandall murder? That search Bernie asked the FBI about because he had nothing left to lose? Well, they got a hit and a possible link to Sherry's killer.
There is a lot of promise there. It's more... This is more promising than anything that I've had in the last 22 years.
That's next time on Murder in a Safe Place. Murder in a Safe Place, Season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written and produced by me, Paul Wagner, and CaseJackets.com. Like what you're hearing so far? Please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. We have more on the Sherry Crandall case, including photos of the family, the videotaped interview with witness Edna Brown, and behind-the-scenes footage with me on our website, AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. Have a question you'd like to see answered in a future show? Email me at paul@wtop.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AMNightmarePod and on Facebook at facebook.com/AMNightmarePod. If you know anything about the murder of Sherry Crandall, you're asked to call Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-TIPS. This podcast series would not be possible without the help of Sherry's three children, the Prince George's County Police, Detective Bernie Nelson, Mike McQuillan, Prosecutor Donna Fenton, Officer Steve Smugareski, and Perpetua Edwards. Editorial assistance from Julia Ziegler and Craig Schwab. Music for this episode is Runway 47 by Immersive Music and Flum Flum by Up North Music. Subscribe today on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.